You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Part of my job is to be an advocate for the president, and I'm going to vigorously defend his decisions and his policies and help him to advance his agenda. But I have another important responsibility as well. That is to make sure that the American people get an accurate account of what's going on here in Washington, D.C., and I work hard to meet both those responsibilities.
Scott McClellan was the White House press secretary from 2003 to 2006, a period during which President Bush made some of his most important and controversial decisions. Those decisions and the scandals that followed eventually led to Mr. McClellan's departure from the White House. They also are the subject of his first book, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. McClellan to the show today. Hello.
Good afternoon. It's good to be on.
Was it when you were still a part of the administration, or was it after you left that you found yourself wondering what happened?
It was primarily after I'd left. When I was leaving, the last 10 months or so, I became a little more disillusioned, or became increasingly disillusioned when some revelations came out that information I'd said publicly turned out to be false. I'd been misled by some senior aides over the Valerie Plame leak episode. And so when I left the White House, things obviously weren't the way we'd hoped they would be. And then when I started thinking about this book, I started writing it. I wanted to know, how did things get so badly off track from this popular bipartisan governor in Texas I went to work for, who became such a polarizing and controversial figure in Washington?
Did you always feel like you were telling the truth?
I felt like I was sincere at the podium, and looking back on it, though, I think that I was misguided in some of what I was saying, and that doesn't really come until you can really get out of that whole Washington environment where you're caught up in this mentality that politics is war, and we need to move beyond that, and that's one of the things I talk about, what happened.
How far into his term as governor of Texas was George Bush when you started working for him?
He was beginning his last session as governor. It was 1999, so he was in his second year of his second term. The terms are 4 years there, but obviously his second term was cut short when he won the presidency. And I had known him since his first – well, I actually met him probably back in the – I think it was around 1988, 1990 time period, and then got to know him during his first run for governor a little bit. Not well, but we knew each other. And I worked in statewide politics and statewide government and got to know him a little bit better when I was chief of staff for a state senator, and then went to – was following a statewide campaign I managed in 1998, I apologize. I was contacted by the governor's office, his top communications advisor, Karen Hughes, and asked if I'd be interested in joining the governor's office. And that's how it all started.
And you liked George Bush at the time, although you disagree with him on the death penalty.
That's true. I've had a lot of affection for the president for a long time. I continue to have personal affection for him, although now I've been able to separate my personal affection for him from my view of some of his judgments and actions that he took. I did write in the book one of the early disagreements I had. I was a spokesman, so obviously I don't get to pick and choose which issues I advocate for or against for the president. I'm there to serve him as well as the people he represents. The death penalty is something I've long had qualms about. And obviously, that was one of the more controversial issues he was known for nationally as well, because of Texas having the highest rate of executions in the country. But I did have to speak on his behalf and express his views. And later issues when it came to the Iraq War, I had some questions about that too.
Looking back to your early years working with Mr. Bush, do you see patterns in his behavior or leadership style that eventually led to your disaffection?
Well, I think I don't know that I saw it necessarily at the time very clearly.
Although you do talk about his saying that he couldn't remember whether or not he'd used cocaine.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
In his partying
phase. That is one thing that during the first campaign for the presidency, it was early 2000, shortly after he was essentially or effectively wrapping up the primary over Senator McCain, and we were traveling and walked into the back room where he took a call from a supporter. And at that time, there's a debate going on about sentencing for using small amounts of cocaine. And so some people were saying, well, if the president had used it, or if young George W. Bush had used it in his young adulthood, then it's hypocritical for him to be advocating stronger sentences or strong sentences for small amounts of it. Anyway, so that issue was kind of the backdrop for the discussion. We went into this room and I told him about a picture that was in the paper that day, him holding his finger to his nose next to a cocaine story. And he told this to the supporter. He goes, you know, they just won't let go of these rumors. And he goes, you know, honestly, I just don't remember whether or not I used it. And I was kind of struck. I thought
– It's not something you forget.
Yeah, no. It's not something you would forget. And so I was now, at the same time, my view is I view it probably a little bit differently than some who might say it's hypocritical. I thought, okay, this is something that may have happened 30 years ago. That's understandable. It's understandable for a politician maybe to say take that position on an issue like that. But later I would see some issues here and there where it would transfer over into policy and it'd become more problematic in terms of someone's judgment.
Well, people ridicule Bill Clinton for saying he didn't inhale.
That's right.
And he should have been ridiculed for that.
But yes.
George Bush should have been ridiculed for saying, I don't remember whether they took cocaine.
Great for the late night comics.
You write that I allowed myself to be deceived. So are we to infer from that that in some sense you were aware that you were purposely being lied to?
In terms of, oh, the...
allowing
no,
yourself
no,
to...
No, in terms of the Valerie Plame leak episode. And now, as a spokesman, we were moving into this controversy which turned into a scandal about whether or not the White House had been involved or White House aides had been involved in leaking Valerie Plame, his identity, who was a covert CIA officer, and her husband, Joe Wilson, of course, was criticizing us publicly. And she got wrapped up in part of the effort to discredit Joe Wilson. Now, I was just becoming press secretary when that happened.
What had you been doing in the interim?
I was the deputy press secretary before that, so I wasn't involved. And as I told investigators and the grand jury when I testified, I wasn't involved in the lead-up to that and anything involving the exposure of her identity. But I then came on as press secretary, and it turned into a scandal and an investigation, and I had to defend the administration. I publicly went out and said that Karl Rove, the president's senior advisor at the time, had a shirt or had not been involved in the leaking of her identity based on conversations I'd had with him, and later exonerated Scooter Libby as well publicly. But I went to both those individuals, and they unequivocally told me when I asked them, were you involved in the leaking of her identity in any way? They unequivocally told me no. And so I took that as an assurance. But at the same time, I knew that, you know, press secretary needs to be or spokesman needs to be careful. So I phrased it in the terms of these individuals assured me they were not involved. So I had a little bit of an out.
But there has been a history from the start of secrecy and obfuscation from this administration. And I don't know whether you had to personally defend Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force and all of that. Now we have Karl Rove saying, citing executive privilege as a reason not to testify before Congress on the politicizing of the Justice Department,
right,
the federal prosecutors,
and
sending a governor to jail, a governor who may very well have not committed a crime.
Right, and I don't know about any specific involvement he might have had with the governor you referenced, Georgia, I believe,
Alabama.
Alabama, I'm sorry. But this White House is probably more secret, more compartmentalized in some of the decisions that are made than at least many of its predecessors, and that's a problem. And that's problematic.
Well, you were at the meetings. What happened?
Did they say we're not going to talk about this?
In some of these,
I was not in these meetings. So that's a problem in itself when the chief spokesman is blocked out of some of the. I was in most of the policy briefings, most of the world leader meetings, things like that. But what happened was that in those meetings, that's not where the decisions got made. They got made in a small group with two or three people, and even the spokesman was kind of left out of some of those. So I didn't understand some of the true motivations behind some of these policies as well as I should have, and that's not good for the public, particularly in this day and age when we've got such a transparent society. You just can't be that secretive. Things are going to get out one way or another, thanks to the job you and others in the media do.
And people like you writing books like this.
Well,
what happened is Scott McClellan's book, Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception, published by Public Affairs. You say that in the lead-up to the Iraq War, many of the president's top advisors were, I'm quoting, evidently pursuing their own agendas. What do you think those agendas were?
I can't get inside their heads, but you obviously had the vice president and some and people like Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, a well-known neoconservative, that had some preconceived views. Certainly one of the things with Vice President Cheney, obviously, looking at Iraq, you know, you've got to think that he's looking at that region and its vast oil reserves and the security interest we have because of that, and thinking about, you know, what kind of influence we could gain if Saddam Hussein's regime was gone. And that was pre-existing prior to 9/11 and prior to the president's decision to go into Iraq. And I think obviously those individuals and Secretary Rumsfeld had a lot of influence on the president's thinking. Now, the president made the decision, and the president, I say in the book, I think that his driving motivation, or I believe strongly that his driving motivation, was really to go into Iraq to transform the Middle East by making Iraq the linchpin for spreading freedom and democracy throughout the region. And it would also be something that would establish a very strong legacy for him someday.
In many cases, including on Iraq, you also seem to cast President Bush as falling prey to Vice President Cheney, to Don Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz's forceful personalities. Do you see the president as a victim of these powerful persuaders?
No, I want to describe it that way because the president's the decision maker. He has to accept responsibility for the decisions that he made. But
there were dissenting voices, like at least at times, Colin Powell.
Yes, certainly Colin Powell, but not many dissenting voices in that inner core of foreign policy advisors. And one of the things I say in the book is that the president, I always noticed, was too deferential to the vice president, too deferential to Secretary Rumsfeld. Secretary Rumsfeld is the kind of guy that wants to do things his way. And when it came to military matters and implementing those, the president pretty much deferred to him, I think, to a large extent. And on the vice president, you mentioned the Energy Task Force. That's one area where the president said, you know, this is yours to kind of implement and do as you see, as well as issues on detainee policy. The vice president obviously was very influential in. And so that's kind of the view. It's not that he was a victim, because the president knew the decision he was making.
Well, didn't he tell you that he believed wartime presidents are the only ones likely to achieve greatness?
Yes, I actually heard him say that more than once. And
so, you know, referencing a war was going to make him great?
Referencing someone like Abraham Lincoln. Well, no, it's not that. I mean, that was something I heard probably after 9/11. And he would, you know, when he talked to people in the Oval Office, he'd point to paintings of, you know, George Washington or an Abraham Lincoln or the bust of Winston Churchill and talk about how great leaders really are wartime leaders to a large extent.
So how soon after 9/11 did the president pull Donald Rumsfeld aside and ask him to draw up war plans for Iraq?
Well, he confirmed in an interview with Bob Woodward for his books that he had pulled him aside in late November and set him to update the war plans for Iraq. And that's when Now, I didn't realize this till later, but I know the president the way he thinks. He tends to be instinctive, and once he sets his course on something, he's pretty much made the decision about what course he's going to follow. And then with Iraq, it was in either Saddam comes clean or he will be removed by our military.
But it was your job to tell the public, a public that was largely hoping for more use of diplomacy, according to the polls, that the president hadn't made up his mind.
Well, actually, at the time, I was the deputy press secretary. My primary focus in the build-up to the war, that is, my primary focus was elsewhere, although I filled in for the press secretary at times and would participate in some of the communication strategy meetings through the White House Iraq Group, which was a marketing arm set up to really sell the war to the American people. Now, I was not involved in the overall strategy that was set out at the beginning for that.
A marketing arm, like an advertising campaign?
Yes. I mean, essentially, or a political campaign is what I refer to in the book, a political campaign aimed at persuading and the American people, and that meant kind of shaping the narrative, the media narrative, to our advantage.
Narrative over facts. Isn't that what press secretaries do? They focus on the narrative whenever they're questioned on the facts. In fact, they often slap anyone down who questions the narrative as being unpatriotic.
Yeah, it's one of the things. I don't think I really got into anything that was, you know, questioning anyone's patriotism. But that, yes, that does happen, and it happens with people in the administration doing that as well. Yes, there's too much political spin, political manipulation that goes on, and that's one of the things I decry in the book, is I got caught up in it just like everybody else.
And half of the people in Congress, if you look at the speeches that were given on both sides of the House and Senate,
absolutely,
you'd be shocked at how they all sound just like the narrative that had been drawn up in the White House.
Absolutely. We were in this post 9/11 environment.
Mushroom cloud.
The environment was smoking gun. Yeah, the environment was working to our advantage. And a lot of people out there in the public, and I was just like them, was willing to give the administration, the president and his foreign policy team, the benefit of the doubt and defer to them, saying, okay, they know what they're talking about if they think this is a serious threat. And, you know, looking back on it, we certainly overstated and overpackaged and oversold the intelligence and the rationale for the war.
The way you describe it, you sound like you're almost out of the loop.
Again, the buildup. I was the deputy press secretary, so I wasn't fully involved in terms of the
Later
I was absolutely in, and I'd come to learn when I was press secretary that sitting in on the president's world leader meetings, traveling with him, how passionate he was about this idea that we could coercively go into the Middle East and transplant democracy there and have it spread.
So weapons of mass destruction were thrown out the window almost from the start.
There
are people who still swear.
Yeah, I mean, I think
hidden in Syria somewhere.
I think that, you know, in terms of the biological and chemical weapons, you know, most people believe that he still had some, and that was legitimate. When you throw in the nuclear threat, which was less certain in terms of the intelligence, or the intelligence community was less confident about, and then you throw in the terrorist connection, you package that together, and it implies something that is more grave and more serious than it really is.
My guest is Scott McClellan. His book, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception, is published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Scott McClellan, who served as White House press secretary from 2003 to 2006. Before that, he served as the principal deputy White House press secretary and as traveling press secretary for the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign. He's written a book called What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception, published by Public Affairs. And the White House often criticized people who tried to discredit the administration. Here's a clip of you, Scott, as press secretary, questioning Joe Wilson's motives for writing his book.
You know, why all of a sudden, if he had all these grave concerns, did he not raise these sooner? This is 1.5 years after he left the administration. And now all of a sudden, he's raising these grave concerns that he claims he had. And I think you have to look at some of the facts. He is bringing this up in the heat of a presidential campaign. He has written a book, and he certainly wants to go out there and promote that book.
Scott, you can't be surprised at the attacks that you've been receiving in the light of what you did to Joe Wilson and what happened to Richard Clark, what happened to Paul O'Neill, and any number of others. They all said the same thing that you said there, and they're saying it about you now. Why not
Sure. Before? It's not unexpected. I actually ran into Dick Clark the other night here in New York, and I apologized to him. I was going out and using our talking points to counter him. I had not even had a chance, and I still haven't, but I do want to read his book. So there I was, ascribing motivations to him when I had not even had a chance to read the book, much like many in the White House or their allies are doing today.
So what were they saying about Richard Clark when that book came out? What were they saying in the White House? He's crazy, or we just got to shoot this guy down?
Well, pretty much discrediting him, saying the timing of the book and things of that nature, much what you just heard in the clip that you played from me. But yes, because he was going out and basically saying that there were steps we weren't taking that he had pushed for the administration, for the White House to do pre 9/11. And then that, you know, I guess he believes may have by some chance helped do something to stop the attacks. So it was a pretty strong challenge that he was making, and the White House certainly felt a need in that instance that we needed to push back pretty hard.
Everybody's been attacking you. Bob Dole, who up until now has mostly been appearing in public service announcements with Bill Clinton or in Viagra ads, has sent out an email calling you a miserable creature and questioning your manhood. A number of hints out there are that you might be gay, some linking you to Jeff Gannon, a.k.a. James Guckert, because he said you were real buds. Are you surprised by all of that?
I'm a little surprised by how personal the nature of it, how personal and the nature has been of some of the comments. Yes, you know, in terms of this, I mean, this book, the larger theme of this book is really taking on the whole culture in Washington and the need to move beyond this destructive permanent campaign atmosphere and get us beyond the bitterly partisan warfare that's going on, that has been going on for at least 15 years, even before we came into office, but we exacerbated. And so, you know, I would expect that creatures of Washington are going to come out and speak pretty strongly against what I'm saying. But what I'm saying, I think when people go and read it, is an open and candid perspective on what my experiences were, what I learned from those, and what we might do to help change some of what's wrong with Washington.
You write up of the lead-up to the Iraq War that, I'm quoting, the public should have been made more aware before the fact of the uncertainties, doubts, and caveats that underlay the intelligence about Saddam Hussein. The administration did little to convey those nuances to people. But that was your job, wasn't it, to convey those nuances?
Well, it was our job at the White House. Yeah. Again,
I mean, I know you weren't press secretary at the moment.
I wasn't press secretary,
but if you had been press secretary,
I did fill in for him.
You wouldn't have done.
Yeah, I did. No, I was caught up in that whole atmosphere, and I was there, you know, believing in the leadership and the person that was in office. And you know, it's hard. You to some extent you lose perspective. You get in there working 18-hour days. You come there with an idealistic streak in you that, hey, we're going to change Washington for the better. And you know, there were some early signs of bipartisan success for the president on the education reforms, working with Senator Ted Kennedy, who of course is in all our prayers today. You know, got terribly off track when we overreacted after 9/11 and overreached by making the decision to push quickly ahead to go into Iraq and remove the regime.
Do you think the administration knowingly deceived the American public or simply chose not to fully inform them? Because it is well documented that high-ranking administration officials were anonymously leaking false information on Iraq, for example, on a link between al-Qaeda and Iraq to reporters. The uranium, there were a whole bunch of other things. Judith Miller wound up going to jail to protect Scooter Libby on some of the, well, not on that, but she had received information from various White House sources that turned out to not always be true.
Right. She was criticized for some of her reporting in the lead up to the war that was taken at word.
Maybe she should have gone to jail for that instead of what she did.
I don't know what was being given to her. But there were some, I can't speak to every individual, and certainly there are individuals that maybe were doing things on their own. But as a general matter, in terms of developing the overall strategy, communication strategy, and sell it for the selling of the war, I don't think there was some grand conspiracy where it was deliberate or conscious to go out there and mislead. I think it was more of this is the way we do it in Washington, the permanent campaign culture, and you go out there and you try to win over that media narrative to your advantage with the public, and that's when it becomes particularly problematic. Most of the time, the permanent campaign is the consequences of it are incidental, harmless, but when it comes and you use that for going to war, we see the dangers of it. It played out with Iraq, and we now know that today.
My guest is Scott McLellan. His book, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception, is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I don't know whether you were uncertain about the need to go to war in Iraq, but let's say you were. Would that have been seen as disloyal if you had raised too many objections at a meeting?
It would have been. I mean, I do think that the war was unnecessary. I'm from a moral standpoint, it's not unsimilar from the death penalty. I very much, in terms of that, you know, there are certain things we shouldn't be getting into making life or death decisions. But with war, it is a moral belief that we shouldn't be going to war unless it's absolutely necessary. There's a direct threat to us that's imminent, or we've been attacked, and then you have to respond.
Well, that's why the weapons of mass destruction.
Right. And
which didn't happen.
If I had raised objections internally, one, as deputy press secretary, I would have been shrugged off. But I gave the benefit of the doubt at the time. I wasn't sure whether or not it was necessary, but I was concerned about how quickly we were moving, but like lots of Americans, was willing to give the administration the benefit of the doubt at the time. But yes, once the decision is made in the president's mind, he expects everybody to follow lockstep and not question the decision. Now, you can question it before in his view, but once it's made, he expects everybody to follow along.
And be on message, as they
That's right, absolutely.
Say. You called the media complicit enablers of the Iraq war. Didn't the administration forcefully threaten the press, especially, for example, when the New York Times revealed the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program?
Well, there are certainly some strong words there that if you do this, you're going to expose some national security secrets. I can't find any that that would be harmful to our national security. I can't find any evidence that it has been with its exposure. And in fact, those investigative reporters did a great job, and their article was delayed for about a year because of the pressure that the president and other top people put on the editors at the New York Times. I was not even aware of that. I was the White House press secretary, and then the day before the night that the New York Times had decided we're going to run with this, I was brought into the chief of staff's office, briefed on it just before its breaking, and the next day was having to go out there and try to defend things. But yes, in terms of the buildup to the war, there were exceptions. McClatchy News reporters did a great job of questioning the necessity of war. But to a large extent, where this post 9/11 environment, as I go back and reflect on it, the media was complicit by focusing too much on the march to war and too caught up in this patriotic atmosphere that existed at the time, instead of really focusing on, as a general matter, doing their job, questioning whether or not it's necessary, challenging all the intelligence. And now I know you all here at WNYC certainly did your questioning as well.
There were a fair number of angry listeners when that questioning occurred. There were pressures from all over the place. Katie Couric says, I think it's one of the most embarrassing chapters in American journalism, and she says there was pressure from the corporate management, not just from Team Bush, to really squash any dissent. And as co-host of NBC's Today show, she says network brass criticized her for challenging the administration. But then 2 weeks into the invasion, she thanked a Navy commander for coming on the show, adding, "And I just want to know, Navy SEALs rock." Tom Brokaw, he says that he was he's very upset with the White House. He blamed the White House and its unbelievable ability to control the flow of information at any time, especially during the time that they were preparing to go to war. But on the first day of the war, he turned to an admiral on a show and declared, "One of the things that we don't want to do is destroy the infrastructure of Iraq, because in a few days, we're going to own that country." So there was a lot of cheerleading going on from people in very powerful places in the media.
That's true.
And they were attacking Scott Ritter as well. They were attacking him as an irrational
person.
Former
weapons inspector.
Blix was attacked.
That's very true. And Hans Blix was asking for more time, and he probably should have been given more time. He was saying he wasn't finding anything. But in terms of the media, and Tom Brokaw did have a point that there's certainly some responsibility at the White House when they put up a pretty strong wall and they're not providing much information. Some people have taken this that I'm blaming just the White House press corps, and it's not really. It's the national press corps in general, the more establishment media. There were White House reporters asking questions too, but they had a tough wall to break. They couldn't get over that wall that the White House had put up. We weren't providing the kind of details that they were looking for.
Religion has played a major role in this primary season. What was the Inner Sanctum's attitude toward the religious right?
Well, the social conservatives, certainly social conservative leaders, from evangelical leaders, the prominent ones, had a lot of say within or influence on the White House. I think that was evident by the way the president made back in 2004 such a big issue or focus on the federal amendment to ban same-sex marriage, the focus on Terri Schiavo later, the limited policy he had on stem cell research. It became the emphasis. And, I think a lot of Americans were looking, why are you focusing so much on these issues? Don't we have bigger priorities to deal with, like health care and energy issues and economic issues, and you're spending your time focusing on this? Well, the reason why is that was to keep those leaders happy and keep the base happy. The president certainly did that, but that's not the kind of guy that he was as governor of Texas when he focused more to the center of governance.
Starting in February 2003, the White House press office started granting one-day press passes for over 2 years to James Guckert, also known by the pseudonym Jeff Gannon, to participate in White House press conferences. Were you involved in that?
I was the deputy press secretary when you're referencing those one-day passes that were starting to be issued to him. I became press secretary in July 2003. It was a staff assistant in our office. The one-day press passes have been in there for quite some time.
But you continue to issue them?
Yes, absolutely.
This is a
yes.
Guy whose journalistic background was pretty much editor of his high school newspaper.
Yeah, no, it was very questionable. You know, my attitude as press secretary was always, and we actually, I was, I think, the first press secretary to allow some bloggers to come into the press brief. My attitude is the more, the better. You know, you're going to be able to, the public's going to be better informed and better served by that. These were bloggers that were, I think, credible news journalist types.
Just a couple of days ago, Gannon wrote on his blog that, I'm quoting, "What I hear about the book does not sound like the Scott McClellan I knew for 2 years. I can say without fear of contradiction that I knew Scott better than any other White House correspondent or Washington reporter."
I don't think that's an accurate reflection of things on his part. I dealt with a lot of reporters, and he was one that I dealt with much less than mainstream ones.
So he's just self-aggrandizing there?
I guess. He certainly has done that in the past, but I would encourage everybody to actually read the book because they'll see my own sincerity come through, I think, when they read it.
Now, a lot has been written about what you have said about Hurricane Katrina and the Valerie Plame Wilson affair. I'm not going to really go into that again. But I wonder about one other thing before you go. The president puts tremendous emphasis on loyalty. How do you think Alberto Gonzalez's loyalty to the president played out when he was chief White House counsel?
Well, he was very loyal and very involved in a lot of controversial decisions, from the detainee policies to the U.S. attorneys and so forth. And I think that was what was so problematic for Al Gonzalez when he became the attorney general. He could not take off his hat and his loyalty to the president and be the kind of independent attorney general that this nation needs to serve the country as a whole versus serve just the president.
The New York Times revealed in March 2005 that many departments under the administration's control, with the help of public relations firms, created phony TV news stories that were then marketed and broadcast as actual news reports. You were a press secretary during that time.
Yeah, but that was done by those individual departments.
And you didn't,
I believe
did
we put a stop to it pretty quick. I'm trying to recall what I'd said at the time on those issues. I can't recall off the top of my head, but it's bad practice. I think we worked behind the scenes after that became known to stop that practice from being done at those agencies.
You write, "Everything that I've seen, both as White House press secretary and as longtime observer of the political scene and the media, suggests that any liberal bias actually has minimal impact on the way the American public is informed."
I think that is true to a very large extent. I think, while most people in the media may lean to the left and be Democratic, whatever you want to say, I think most of them are professionals and they know their responsibility. And their responsibility is to hold elected officials account, to make sure the American people are informed. And I think they're able to make that distinction. But it's also good for another reason, because if you look at government and people in government, most of them are moderate to conservative. And I would prefer people that are to the left are going to be more skeptical and more challenging, and as long as they can be professional as they do it, I think that's fine. If they're not, it's going to become known anyway, given all the various news outlets we have today.
And that skepticism was something that we saw in Gail Collins's Sunday Times op-ed piece, and she wrote of you, "His White House career could have been so different if, when Bush started babbling about WMDs in Iraq, McClellan reminded himself that this was coming from a guy who couldn't remember what drugs he had ingested."
Yeah, it might well have been, but I didn't look at it in those terms. I thought the drug issue was something that was forgivable, and my affection for the president probably clouded my judgment in terms of some of his actions.
Well, now you can't talk to the guy anymore, alas.
I don't think so.
But we see you on the cover having a conversation, the cover of What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception, published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us, Scott McClellan.
Thanks, Leonard. Glad to be here.